This is an interview with Peter Bullimore of Sheffield, England, discussing schizophrenia, recovery, and the Hearing Voices and Paranoia Network support groups. The interview was conducted in December of 2005 and was produced and engineered by Will Hall of the Freedom Center and Valley Free Radio. Running time is 23 minutes. For more information, contact www.asylumonline.net, freedom-center.org/radio, or valleyfreeradio.org.
My name is Peter Bullimore. I live in Sheffield in England. I finished up in the mental health system. I put it down to the fact that I was sexually abused from the age of 5 up to 13, and I never spoke about any of the incidents. And through later life, I had a family very, very young and got married very young, and the pressure always mounted up and mounted up to the point where I eventually started my own business, but the problem was when I'd been a child going through the abuse, I'd started to hear voices, and at first it were quite reassuring. Then after a while they got very, very destructive, because the problem was with sexual abuse, as you get older, sometimes your body responds and you can't understand why. You're hating what's happening, but you know some of the sensations are pleasurable and you can't really understand why that is happening. And over a period of years, the voices kept coming and going. Then when I got to 13, the abuse stopped and the voices went away. And then I got married at 17, a very young age. And I'd never spoke about the voices or the abuse, but I was always felt under pressure providing for a family and everything. And I eventually started my own business, manufacturing fire surrounds. It was a very good business. We were turning £1 million a year over. But with all of that comes a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. And it's interesting, my abuser, I never call her an abuser. I call her a tormentor, because I always say she tormented my mind, but she abused my body. My body healed, my mind didn't. And I always had a big fear of authority and women shouting. And when I was married, my wife really liked the lifestyle that we got at that point. But I was working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I was never at home, and she used to be complaining. She used to ring me up and say, you know, I think you're a bad father, you're never at home. All I was trying to do was provide. Because she was shouting at me down the phone, I felt like a woman was tormenting my mind again. And it really, really started to affect my behaviour through the stress of the business and my family life crumbling. I started to get really, really paranoid. And I was to read significant things into some registration plates. If I saw one that said BGW, it would mean Big White God. And I'd make all significant, read messages through it and think people were following me. The voices really started to take hold at that point, and I got really bad visual hallucinations as well. Probably people may have seen the film Nightmare on Elm Street with Freddy Krueger. He often used to come and visit me, come through the mirror, or I'd see him in back of the van. And I got very, very distressed with it, to the point where I think the final coup de grace of it all was when I had a out-of-body experience, and I actually thought I'd died, and I couldn't get back in my body. I eventually did get back in my body, and I started to cry uncontrollably, which is something I learned as a child. You don't do, because it's a sign of weakness. And then from there, my behaviour again spiralled out of control, the voices got worse, the paranoia got worse, and it led to basically being sectioned under the Mental Health Act. During the first admission, I stopped looking in the mirror, because I couldn't see myself. I used to say all I could see was a demon. The demon had long hair, it had a beard, and it was black round the eyes. But looking back, that was me. No one encouraged me to get a shave, cut my hair. And I was taking a combination of 25 different drugs a day, and I'd gone black round the eyes. And after a period of time, about 6 months, I think it was, I'd said to my nameless, I want to go home, I've really had enough in here. And it was Monday morning, a ward round was Monday morning, and it was 9 o'clock. And he said, well, if you sit at the end of the ward, Pete, I'll get you in to see the doctor. And as I said, this was 9 o'clock Monday morning. And 6 o'clock, I was still sat there, not had a drink, nothing to eat, not been to the loo. And eventually I said to him, when am I going to see the doctor? And he said, I'm sorry, Pete, I forgot all about you. So this really, really wound the voices up. And the following week, he did exactly the same thing again, left me sat there all day. So eventually when I did get out, I got out by lying my way out, told lies that everything was okay. And it got to the point where I did get released, but my parents and my wife said, you know, what's wrong with him? And they said, it's confidential, ask Peter. But no one had explained anything to me. And I went home and we have real bad night terrors. They're really, really frightening. And I was asleep with the light on. But for some reason, my wife turned the light off. And I had this night terror and I jumped up screaming. And she went to comfort me. But I couldn't see her. I could only see what was in this night terror. And I actually jumped on her and started to strangle her. Fortunately for her and for me, she got free and locked herself in the room downstairs. But that left me and three young children upstairs in a very disturbed state. And I'm glad to say I never went anywhere near the children. All I got from that was resectioned. I think had they been truthful with her, she'd have said, I can't really have him at home yet. It's a bit too risky. And I just think where carers and families are concerned, the Confidentiality Act nearly needs to be addressed because it's too one-sided. The only people it protects is it's the staff. It doesn't protect the family in any way. So again, I was resectioned, even to the point where I came back from breakfast one day and I was just given more and more drugs. My arms locked, so it just looked like I was pushing a wheelbarrow all the time. And as I got back, there was a man in my bed. And I said to him, you're in my bed. And he said, well, it's mine, they've given it me. So I thought, well, I'm not prepared to argue with you. So I went to see the nursing staff, but I broke an unwritten law on the wards in the Sheffield hospitals. And that is, you don't disturb nursing staff while they're having a bacon sandwich or you become public enemy number one. And I did this. And I said, there's someone in my bed. And they said, yes, we know. I said, well, what am I supposed to do? And they said, Peter, we've got 32 patients, 29 beds. We'll send someone home at 6 o'clock and you can have your bed back. And I said, well, I can't really do that. I need to lay down. And so, well, tough, deal with it. So I'm a non-smoker. So I went in the TV room and laid on the seats. And the same member of staff came in and said, seats are for sitting on, not laying, get up. Now, I have to bear in mind at this point, I was sectioned and I wandered off the ward. No one stopped me. And I found the administration block and there was a disabled toilet. So I went in and locked the door. And I took my jumper off as a pillar and I slept on the toilet floor. And I went back at 6 o'clock. Nobody asked me where I'd been, what I'd been doing or anything. And that's what I did for 2 weeks, sleeping on the toilet floor. And that just does not help my mental state. And eventually I told my parents, who kicked up a fuss, but the reply was, well, what can we do if we've not got enough beds? And they said, well, I'm not prepared to let him sleep on a toilet floor. You know, so it was kind of the whole ethos of the things, just very, very badly managed and very badly supervised. It was a really scary first admission because I was put in a side room and I didn't really know what was going on. And this doctor, it was a female doctor that came to see me at first. And she said, can you tell me what's been happening? So I explained the best I could. And she said, well, I think I'll start by giving you a rectal examination. Now, I've never found out why she should want to do that. So I felt they was going to abuse. They got me there to be abused again. So I tried to run away and I was stopped by this male nurse. And at that point, I was sectioned under the Mental Health Act. And then a consultant came to see me and he said, it was as blunt as this. He just said, Mr. Bullimore, you are a chronic schizophrenic. You will never, ever work again. Go away and enjoy your life. And that was it. Then got up and walked away. No explaining what is chronic schizophrenia, what am I supposed to do? But it took 10 years out of my life because there was days I wanted to do things, but because he said I couldn't, I didn't even try. I got a good worker. It was an occupational therapist called Sally, and she was a massive influence on my life because she actually treated me, not my diagnosis. And there's a massive feeling of oppression in the mental health system. And it's not really what workers create, but your self-esteem and your confidence is really, really shot. So you see everybody on a pedestal and you're a lot lower than them. But she addressed that balance of power. She actually told me a bit about her own experiences in life. And I saw her as a person that does have trauma and have stresses. But she also identified, she said, you socially isolate yourself on a Friday night. You were sexually abused on a Friday night. Why do you do this? And we worked through it together. And we have a lot of red tape in the mental health system, but she didn't really care about it. She said, you know where I live. Don't be on your own on a Friday. Come and see me. I knew I never went twice and I had a glass of wine with her and a partner and I left. And I would never abuse it, but I knew she was there. It made a massive difference. And I also then got a very, very good new psychiatrist called Paul Rowlands. And Paul was amazing. He was young, he was enthusiastic. He started to reduce my medication. But the thing I really liked about him was he had an open door policy. He didn't need an appointment. If you knocked on his door and he was free, you could go in. I really shot myself in the foot with that a lot because I'd started to attend a Hearing Voices group, which was really instrumental in my life. I actually met people with the same experiences and I didn't have to wear a mask anymore and I felt I belonged somewhere in this organisation. But I foolishly decided I'd evaluate my life one day. I thought I don't really need anybody. So I looked at what had happened. I used to have 9 people working for me. And since my first admission, I hadn't seen anyone. So I thought perhaps my disciples had betrayed me. And I'd had an out-of-body experience. I thought, well, I've died and resurrected. I'd been on the acute ward, so I'd been to hell and back. So to me, it fitted, I must be Jesus Christ. So I thought, I need to check this out. So I made my way to Sheffield Cathedral to show myself. But as I got to the big wooden doors, I suddenly thought, oh, Christ, they crucified Christ. I must have a Last Supper. So I went across to McDonald's and I got this sausage and egg McMuffin contemplating my crucifixion. And then I went back in my scruffy state. And as I walked in, this man stopped me. I was really the archetypal schizophrenic, didn't wash a shave or anything, scruffy. And he asked me what I wanted. I said, I've come to see the main man, I've come to show myself. And he sat chatting to me, but he didn't really grasp the thread of what I was saying. And then he got up and left me. And in the Sheffield Crucible, in the cathedral at that time, there was 2 pulpits, one facing you and one side on. And this vicar was doing a sermon side on some old age pensioners. So I seized my chance and I ran down the cathedral and he never saw me coming. And I actually just jumped in the pulpit at the side of him and he actually turned around and went, Christ Almighty. So I thought, fantastic, he recognises me. And he had to stop the whole sermon and he took me in the back room and he says, what are you playing at? And I just kept, I thought you recognised me. And we had this long drawn out conversation with him saying, have you ever been in a mental hospital? And I said, well, a few times, what's that going to do with anything? And he said, I'm starting a group for people with mental health problems. This was around February time. And he said, would you like to come? So he took all my details. He said he was starting the group in September. Well, all I can think is he meant September 2007, because I've never heard from the guy since. But at this point, as I was doing these crazy things, Sally was always there. You're not stupid. You're quite intelligent. You can. And she was a rock. As much as I put the barriers up, she was always there. And Paul was really reducing my medication. And my life was getting back. My limbs were freer. But I foolishly shot myself in the foot again. I thought, I've got to be able to work this out. There's got to be some reasoning why this is happening. So I looked at what happened in my life. I looked at the child sexual abuse. I'd lost my family, my home, my business. I'd been told I'll never have a future. And I thought, well, perhaps I was born to kill myself. It's preordained and this is my destiny. So I thought, before I kill myself, I'll go and tell Paul, the psychiatrist. Now, Paul's office was very, very small. It was enough for 2 chairs and about 12 inch back to the wall behind it. And I went to see him and I said, Paul, I've worked it out. And he said, come on then, Pete, what is it today? And now when you've took volumes of medication over years, you forget words and you get thought blocking. So I'm sat in front of this consultant psychiatrist and I said, Paul, I was born to kill and couldn't think of the word myself. So I kept repeating, I was born to kill. And you've never seen a chair move back the last 12 inches fast in all your life. And he doubled my medication, sectioned me and went to work in another trust. So I was... You know, I never got a chance to say it was nothing personal, like, you know, but I still got him in real high regard, like, you know. So there were factors around that, but people didn't give up on me. I think that was it. But it was interesting, we saw both ends of the scale, and I'd love to see Paul again, actually, tell him how much good he did do. But when I was, because of my comments and I was resectioned, I met another psychiatrist called Fernandez, and the only way I can describe her is she was a bastard. She hated me with a vengeance. If I looked at her, my drugs would go up. I'm supposed to think, don't smile, because you get lithium thrown in as well. And she just bombarded me. I was really into polypharmacy. And my parents used to bring me towels in. And I used to have the towels as bibs, but a slaver continually pouring out of my mouth. And my legs would be bouncing on the bed. And I said, can you tie my legs down? And obviously they couldn't do that. And eventually she sent for me. And I said, when am I going home? She said, you're not. So I said, well, why not? She said, because you don't speak to people. You don't speak to staff. You don't speak to patients. I just said, well, I've got nothing to say. So if you don't start speaking to people, I will never, ever let you out of here. So I started telling my name nurse what the voices were saying. Then when I got on ward round, she said, we can't let you go. You're too delusional with what you're telling the staff. But eventually I did get out. I was very much a revolving door patient for a lot of years. But I think the biggest turning point really was after my mum died, I suppose. And the voices really, really took me to town on this, saying it was my fault. They actually told me when my mum got admitted to hospital, she was being checked for kidney stones. And the voices told me she got cancer and she'd be dead in 6 months. And my mum died 6 months later of cancer. Now, at that time, it really I could look back at that now and say it's coincidence, but at the time it screwed my mind up and the voices were always there saying, it's your fault, they blame you, your dad blames you and all this, that and other. And I got to the point where they told me where I lived was possessed with demons, the only safe place was the kitchen. So I started to live in the kitchen, it's where I ate, it's where I slept, it became my toilet, so you can imagine the conditions I was living in. I decided, I can't live this life anymore. So I'd do what the voices said. So I covered myself in petrol and I walked into the day centre to set myself on fire. Now, when you're a non-smoker, you find out who your friends are when you ask for a light and you smell of petrol. Fortunately, no one obliged. And again, at this point, I was resectioned. But this, I think this was the biggest turning point. My dad came to visit me. Well, he rang me up. He said, I'll come at 7 o'clock. Well, 8 o'clock, he wasn't there. And the voices said, he's not coming. He blames you for your mum's death. So I went to my bed bay and I smashed open my razor and I slashed my wrists. As I did it, my dad walked in with a nurse. And you can imagine, Banks, it was blood up the walls and everything. And I was sat in this room with him and he asked me why I did it. And I said, it's your fault. You should have been here at 7. He says, but Peter, I'm in Aldridge. I was stuck in traffic. I always turn up. My dad was a massive, massive, strong man. And his comments that really shook me next time, he just said, I've just lost your mum. I don't want to lose you. And it was a look of utter despair on his face. I'd reduced him to nothing with my behaviour. And it made me realise, stop being a selfish bastard, because you were hurting other people, not just yourself. But my dad had done everything for me. So had Sally, so had Paul Rowlands. The reason I wasn't trying was because 10 years prior, a psychiatrist said, you will never, ever work again. And his words were so powerful. But eventually I did get released, and my marriage had broke up at this point, and I got divorced. And I kind of went into a relationship with someone I was told shouldn't go into. She was a lot younger, and people said she'd got a violent past. But the seed, I'd actually met people from the Hearing Voices Network years before as well, and that seed had been sown that this organisation existed. And this relationship I was in was okay at first, and for reasons known only to this woman, she got extremely drunk one night. And for no reason, smashed a vase in my face, put 14 stitches in my face and carved my body up like a draughts board. And it went to court and Sally came with me. And as we came out of court, she asked me how I was and I said, I'm not too bad actually, I'm glad it's over. She said, well, I didn't ask you that. I said, how are you? I said, well, I'm all right. She said, how are your voices? I said, I haven't got any. She said, you've just turned a corner of your life. Usually this amount of stress would put you back in hospital. Had she not said that, I may not have realised. And she said, you've got to build on this moment. And she actually took me to the pub and we sat there, we had a lot to drink. She says, you're not leaving here until you've decided what you're going to do with your life. And she convinced me to set up my own Hearing Voices group, which says we're going to do it on support and education. And we set this group up, which we've now got 63 members. And I remembered the Hearing Voices Network from years before who I'd met. And I invited them to Sheffield to come and do a workshop around voices. And I was talking to the main speaker afterwards. Now, all he knew about me was I was a voice hearer. And I just said to him, I like the way you work with voices, but you're talking about voices with identities. Mine are demonic. They've got no identity, no gender. And he just looked me straight in the eye and he said, Peter, address the demons of your past. And the demons of my past was my abuser. And when I saw her, I still used to run away. And I decided I needed to address the demons. And I saw one Saturday afternoon walking down the road and my first instinct was to run. But I thought, no, I need to do something. So I kept walking, my heart was really beating, but I kept eye contact all the way. And as I got closer, she actually turned and looked away. And I suddenly thought, perhaps I could get this woman in a lot of trouble. But by doing that, I'd address the balance of power. She had no hold over me, I didn't have to fear her. But then I suddenly thought, well, so what? How can this help me with voices? So I thought about it in great detail, and I rang my children up, and I said, don't contact me for 2 weeks because I need to lock myself away. And I started to listen to the voices very intently and how to write down the content. And they were always referring to abuse. But I was an innocent in that. So what I had to do is I had to find myself not guilty. And I also had to forgive myself because the abuse had nothing to do with me. But the more and more I listened to the voices, I found out there was a dominant voice. And in voice hearing, there's always a dominant voice. Might be a little more critical, more destructive, maybe a little bit louder. But I gave the dominant voice the identity of my abuser. So it was my abuser that was tormenting me in my mind. But she had no hold over me. I didn't fear her in the living. So I wasn't going to let her destroy my mind anymore. So I could challenge the validity of the content of the voice and what she was saying. And I thought, well, sure, right, she's always, this is my dominant voice, this is my abuse, talking about abuse. But it's me that's keeping it a negative. Maybe she's saying, deal with it. Deal with the abuse and move on. So I actually turned it into a positive. And from that, once I took the fear of the voices away, my recovery was very, very rapid. I'm the founder member of the Paranoia Network in the United Kingdom. I think it's an interesting story how it came around. A psychiatric nurse came to see me, and he said, "I've got this young guy. He's really, really paranoid. He's not doing anything but drink and eat junk food. His marriage is broke down, but he does want to do something." And this guy came to see me, and he was really, his paranoia was really about drugs, really hooked into this paranoid world. But he did want to do something. So we talked at length, and then I just says to him, "Are you interested in your own paranoia? Are you interested in paranoia in general?" And he said, "I'm interested in paranoia in general." And I just said, "Do you think a support group would work for people with paranoia?" And he said, "Well, I'm not really sure." So we decided we'd have a stab at it. So we just booked a room in an old school, so it'd be non-intimidating, like no medicalised centre or anything. And we just did a blanket mail out. We did drugs and alcohol reobs, statutory and voluntary sector, libraries, everywhere that this group was starting. We didn't know who was going to turn up. We just going to set a date and a time. And the amazing thing was, on the day, 15 people turned up. We was expecting two or three, so when 15 walked in, we couldn't believe it. But the one that really stuck out to me was a guy called Jim. And Jim had not been out of the house for 5 years because he was so paranoid. And his worker had took him the flyer in. And he'd actually made his own way there. He'd got on the bus and the tram system. And when we asked him why he'd come, he says, "Because I thought there was only me. I've come to meet like." And his recovery was amazing. He actually does a work around the Paranoia Network office. He's got a part-time job in a charity shop. He gets to see his mum, who'd been in a respite centre for years we'd never got out to see. So to me, he's the biggest success story ever. But it's interesting how people create people's paranoia. There was ex-police woman that came who'd seen her colleagues beating someone up in a cell, and she threatened to report them. And they said, "If you do that, you know, you'll be kicked out of the force and your life won't be left worth living." So they actually created, she'd actually left the police force. So they created her paranoia. It's all like grounding in something. And there was a woman that came along. And again, she was a middle-aged woman, and she said she'd come along because her husband told her she was paranoid. So she started to act paranoid to justify the husband. Well, actually, she wasn't. It was about him controlling her. And eventually, she admitted herself to hospital for a month. And she said it was the best month of her life. She didn't have to pretend people cared for her. And when she came back to the group, she just said, "What shall I do now, Pete?" And my advice was, divorce the bastard. Which she did. She divorced him. She's got her own place. She's got a job. And she's not paranoid anymore. I think he was the one that was paranoid that she may leave him. He wanted to control her. And from there, we thought, well, we'll start a paranoia network. No one's really done it. And we actually went to Northern College at Barnsley. And we met together. Because what we're hoping to do is write a book on paranoia. And it's going to be people's stories of paranoia. And it's going to be called Making Sense of Paranoia, A Gift of Stories. And we went to this meeting to formalise the Paranoia Network and how to get people to learn how to write a book, write their own, you know, their own stories. And then we actually got some premises for it as well. We've got his own office. But then we had a conference in Manchester last year, and it was amazing. There was 120 people turned up. We could have got double the amount in, but we didn't have enough space. And they came from Scotland, they came from Wales, they came from Ireland. An interesting thing was, it was because no one does anything around paranoia. People say, paranoid, I don't know what to do with this person. They don't seem to understand it, but it's a common human experience. It's usually grounded in something. And from there, it's grown. I think it's probably only about six groups in the country, but it's six more than what we had before. I still get voices today, but I always say to people, you know, the message to me from my life story is, when I was in the system broke me, and the system made me very, very weak. And I would say, if the weak person I became can change, then anybody can change.